Right, so I would like to talk about a subject that is directly on the theme of the conference, I think, and that is the connection between a particular approach to forcing, Boolean valued models approach, on the one hand, and a metaphysical theory that's not very popular, but that I think has some potential. That's the theory of arbitrary object theory. I want to make a link between these two, between these two things. All right, there's a clock there. Okay, so in philosophy of physics, when we look at philosophy of physics, then what people are have been doing a lot in the second half of the 20th century is take our best physical theories and investigate what our physical world could be like given what these physical theories tell us. Well, what I think, what I would like to do today is to do something similar for philosophy of mathematics and in particular philosophy of set theory. So I would like to take our best set theory, our best theories from set theory as given, and the practice of set theory as given, and see what the set theoretic world could be like given this given the way set theory is like. So, and I'm going to focus, as I said, on Boolean valued models as they've been developed in one approach of to forcing, to finding independence results. And and that's the Boolean valued models approach. I will talk a little bit about it in a few minutes. But in set theory, this is a technique that is used to find independence results. It's a very powerful technique. And what I want to argue is that this technique also has, in a fairly direct way, can be taken to have, in a fairly direct way, foundational relevance. And that, I think, is not so often argued. So there are two approaches to forcing. So there's the post-set approach to forcing, going back to Cohen. Many of you here know much more about this than I do. And there's the Boolean valued models approach, going back to Scott and Solovey, late 1960s. And that's what I'm going to talk about. But I think a structurally similar story could be told in terms of the post-set approach. I'm just going to fix on the Boolean valued models approach because somehow I think it more intuitively conveys the picture that I want to paint here. Okay, so let's see. The structure of my talk is going to be as follows. I'm going to start by saying something about arbitrary object theory, and this is mainly because it's a theory that is not very well known in metaphysics. I know that many people here are philosophers and know a lot about metaphysics, but still it's very possible that many of them just hardly know anything about arbitrary object theory. So I'm going to say a few things about this. Then I'm going to talk about the Boolean valued models approach to forcing. I'm going to give the key elements of it, review the key elements of it. I know that there are people in this audience for whom this is totally redundant, but nonetheless, I'm going to say something about it. And then I'm going to try to connect the two. Specifically, what I will argue is that I will present a metaphysical view for consideration, according to which the set theoretic universe is a Boolean valued class model. And that this Boolean valued class model can be seen as an arbitrary object, a very big one, an arbitrary object, which can be in different states. Moreover, this class model consists of arbitrary entities, of Boolean valued sets. So somehow Boolean valued sets have to be seen as arbitrary objects. Now, this is not completely straightforward, so there will be a problem, a reversing arrows problem, that will be addressed in somewhere in the middle of this talk. But I think it's not hard to see how this problem can be addressed. And then I'm in a position to sketch the views which I put forward for consideration here, which I call kaleidoscopic absolutism. And I will end my talk with considerations about identity, the role of identity in this picture, because I think it's important. Now, this is very much work in progress, so that's one caveat here. I've benefited a lot from talking to Hazel Brickhill about these things, and there are relations with certain other views that have been proposed recently, in particular a view that has been proposed by Chris Scambler, who's going to give the next talk, I think. But I won't have time to talk about that right now. So let us start. So arbitrary objects are supposed to be objects that can be in the state of being this or that object, one object or another object or a third object, and so on and so forth. So let's start with a few examples to develop intuition. In legal theory, at least in the UK and in the English-speaking world, the man on the Clapham omnibus is a significant term. It's supposed to be a man or woman, okay, it says man, but it's supposed to be gender neutral in legal theory, who is reasonable and not too dim, so fairly intelligent. Doesn't have to, it's not supposed to be a genius of any kind, but not too dim. So that's what this person is supposed to be. So it's an arbitrary person. This person could be Caroline, could be me, but it isn't Caroline and it isn't me. So that's a first example of an arbitrary object. Second example is taken from, let's say, mathematical practice at a very low level. So take a mathematician who says, take an arbitrary natural number, and then she goes on to reason about this arbitrary number, prove things about this arbitrary number, and maybe conclude things about all natural numbers, all specific natural numbers from that. So the idea is that when a mathematician says this, we're going to take this seriously. So there are the specific numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then there are arbitrary numbers. And the arbitrary number that this mathematician talked about could be the number 0, could be the number 1, could be the number 2, but isn't the number 0. It could be in a certain state, but it isn't that specific number. Now, talking about arbitrary numbers or variable numbers was fairly commonly done in the 19th century until a guy came around called Gottlob Frege, who criticized this practice very strongly, and after that this practice went away. So in the 19th century, mathematicians were sort of taking this fairly seriously, this idea of there being variable numbers. But after Frege and Russell in 1905, no more. and this is still the prevailing view. So most metaphysicians, most philosophers, think there are no arbitrary objects at all. No. So in particular, there are no arbitrary natural numbers. But I'm going to take this view seriously. And one small, and I'm not going to defend it here, but one small indication of why we might want to call it, take it seriously, is that there is a notion that plays a role in our best scientific theories. That's the notion of random variable. It's all over the place in probability theory and statistics. And that seems to be the kind of thing that could be called should be called an arbitrary object. So what is a random variable for those of you who don't have this in their the front of their mind at the moment? Well, you take a probability triple, so a sample space, a sigma algebra on it, and then a probability function. And then you take a function from the from this sample space into some sort of into a set, right? And then such a function is called a random variable. And you can see that if you consider this in against the context of this probability triple, then you can bring to bear probabilistic considerations on these kind of things. So maybe it. These things should be taken a little bit more seriously than philosophers do. So we can talk about arbitrary natural numbers, arbitrary people, arbitrary f's. Now, what is an arbitrary f? Well, for mathematical purposes, but this is a question of modeling, this is not what they are metaphysically, but this is how they are straightforwardly modeled. An arbitrary f is just a function from a state space, right? The states that this arbitrary entity can be in, possible situations of some sort, to an outcome space, a value range. And typically, this value range consists of specific objects. So when I was talking about this mathematician, we started out saying, take an arbitrary natural number, and then the value range of that thing consisted of specific numbers. Right? That doesn't have to be like that, though, because nothing prevents the value range to also contain arbitrary objects itself. I mean, this is a very natural idea, and indeed, this will turn out to play a crucial role in my story here. Moreover, there are many arbitrary f's if you have a category f. So, for instance, to give again a simple example. Suppose we start, we say, take an arbitrary number strictly between 3 and 6. Well, call it, call it A1. Well, then this number A1 could be the number 4, and it could be the number 5. Could be in the state of being the number 4, could be in the state of being the number 5. But then there is another arbitrary number, A2, that is also an arbitrary number, strictly between 3 and 6, but which is not A1. And that's the number which is anti-correlated with A1. For instance, this is the number, or a number, if there are even more than that, that is in the state of being the number 4, exactly when A1 is in the state of being the number 5, and it's in the state of being the number 5, specific number 5, exactly when A1 is in the state of being the number 4. So that means that there are at least two arbitrary natural numbers strictly between 3 and 6. So even for an f with such a limited value range, only two objects, there are more than one arbitrary f's. Now these states, they need not be maximally specified. So if they're maximally specified, then they're possible worlds in the Carnapian sense of the world. It need not be like that, right? They can be partially specified states, let's say sets of Carnapian possible worlds that can be refined to more and more specific states, right? We will allow that, so we're going to be a little bit liberal. The values need not be specific objects, so I could also say, I could also talk about arbitrary natural numbers strictly between 3 and 6. Well, these would be things that could be in the state of being the arbitrary natural number A1, but could also be in the state of being the arbitrary natural number A2, right? So that's a natural thing to do. Moreover, arbitrary, and this will not, the third thing will not really play a role in what I'm going to say, but arbitrary objects can be undefined in some states. So I'm don't have any problem with allowing states where there are no people. Well, in such a state, the man on the Clapham omnibus doesn't take a value. That's not a problem. So what one could try to do is develop arbitrary object theory in general, and that's what I've tried to do to some extent over the past years. But another thing one could try to do is find applications of arbitrary object theory. I've already indicated one, random variables. I think that's possible application area. And there's another possible application area that was already noted by Kit Fine in 1985. He said, well, one might try to apply arbitrary object theory to Boolean valued models approach enforcing. Something, he said something like that. As far as I know, this has not been worked out in detail, and my plan here is to work this out in some detail. The fact that random variables is a possible application area for our arbitrary object theory should already give us some hope, because maybe some of you have read Dana Scott's original article from 1967 in which the Boolean valued models approach to forcing is first explained in detail. And there he starts, I mean, if you just look at the first pages of this, he says, well, let's start with random variables. Let's take a probability triple, and he's not going to be specific about the sample space at that point. At some point he's going to make choices, of course, but so let's just take a probability triple and consider functions from the sample space of this probability triple to the real numbers. Let's call these arbitrary reals, or arbitrary reals, or random reals is maybe what he calls them, arbitrary or random reals. And what he's then going to do, I mean, and this is going to be the center thing in his model construction, he's going to build a model in which the quantifiers ranging over the real numbers range over these random reals. And he's going to make sure that there are lots of random reals in the domain, random reals that are somehow orthogonal to each other. Well, that was 1967, and immediately after that, this talk of random reals went away from standard explications of the Boolean valued models approach. For instance, if you look at the Bell book from 2005, you won't find it in there anymore because it's not as essential. But it was of motivational value. And what I want to argue that is that even though on the surface it looks like this talk is not immediately there anymore, slightly below the surface, it actually plays a more pervasive role in modern approaches to Boolean-valued model forcing than even in Dana Scott's original approach. Okay, so what did Scott try to do? He wanted to build a Boolean-valued class model for the language of set theory, in which all of standard set theory holds, set FC holds, but the continuum hypothesis is false, or some other set theoretic statement is is false. Then if you want to build a model, then you have to answer two basic questions. What first one is, what do the quantifiers range over? What is the domain of discourse of this model? And what's the truth definition? Okay, so that's what Scott and Solovey did. They said, and now I'm switching to the modern presentation of the Boolean valued models approach. They say, well, let's start with a complete Boolean algebra. And excuse me, the elements of this complete Boolean algebra will be our truth value. So somehow the notion of truth value is generalized here. And this is no longer a linear ordering of degrees of truth even, right? Okay. And the elements of the universe are functions, the Boolean valued sets. They're functions from the Boolean valued universe. So they're functions from the Boolean valued sets into this Boolean algebra. Now you might think at first sight, oh, this looks a little bit circular. Is this really a definition? But these functions are recursively defined, so there's absolutely no circularity here. That's what these things look like. Okay? And then, so we know what the domain of discourse is. Now we want to know what the truth definition is. Well, the truth definition contains clauses for atomic cases and clauses for complex cases. And here the complex cases are exactly what you would expect. So for instance, the truth value, the Boolean truth value of a conjunction is the meat of the Boolean values of the conjuncts, for instance. And same thing for complement and so on. For negation, it's defined in terms of complement. There's absolutely no surprise there, so I'm not going to write it down. So the important clauses are the atomic clauses. And there is an identity, so the atomic formulas are of two kinds. So they can be identity statements, or they can be elementhood statements. And the elementhood statement is defined in some complicated way. In terms of the elementhood statement clause is defined in some complicated way in terms of the Boolean values of identity statements, and the one for identity statements is defined in somewhat complicated way in terms of the Boolean values of elementhood statements. Again, you might wonder a little bit about circularity here, but complexity is reduced in both cases, so there is no circularity here. It's recursively defined. It's absolutely okay, so let's see. And the reason that these two are entangled with each other is that identity and elementhood is, of course, that identity and elementhood in set theory are intimately related with each other through the axiom of extensionality. Right, so that's what you do. So now you've specified the notion of a model, and in general, and then it can be shown that if you start with a complete Boolean algebra, then the Boolean valued model that we've defined relative to this Boolean valued algebra makes all the axioms of set FC true. And here, this is a kind of a lazy way of writing that the Boolean the Boolean value of any theorem of set FC is 1, is the top element. And of course, the reason why they're interested in doing this kind of thing is that for some complete Boolean algebra B, but now you have to make choices carefully, this Boolean valued model makes the continuum hypothesis false, right? Again, in the Boolean valued sense, lazy notation. And then this is one corollary from this is that continuum hypothesis does not follow from ZFC. Right, so that's how that goes. And now I want to relate this to this to arbitrary object theory. So I want to conceive of VB, this Boolean valued universe, as an arbitrary entity that can be in states, and that has arbitrary objects as its elements. Now, how are we going to do that? So what we need, if we want to interpret this in terms of arbitrary objects, is a state space and an outcome space. But we have already a state space. So our Boolean algebra is a state space in a very straightforward sense. So given the Stone representation theorem, we can conceive of this complete Boolean algebra as a field of sets, where for instance, the meat is interpreted as ordinary set intersection. So that means that these elements of this Boolean algebra can be conceived of as sets of points, sets of possible worlds. That means situations. States in the set in the sense in which I've introduced them, let's say 15 minutes ago. Okay, so we can regard B as a state space, and then most states are partial states, and very often the models that people work with are in most of the models that the set theorists work with, all of the states are partial states because these Boolean algebras that they're working with are not atomic. Well, okay, and then what is our outcome space, right? Well, that will be VB, right? That will be our arbitrary, that will be our Boolean valued sets. seen themselves as arbitrary objects. So this is inevitably going to be arbitrary objects all the way down, of course. But the problem is that the arrows are pointing in the right way, in the wrong direction. So we said in the beginning that an arbitrary object is a function from a state space into the outcome space. But what we've got here is a function from the outcome space into the state space. Arrows point in the wrong direction. So that has to be solved. But it can be fairly easily solved. So what I want to show is, and here a picture will be useful. Let me try to. Yes, so this picture may not be as clear as if it would be if I had more colors, but I try to do it with, well, I think it will, I can make it clear. So here, so suppose we have a Boolean valued set. Well, that's a function that has a domain, set size domain. Let's say it has three elements here. And it's a function into this Boolean algebra. That's our U. What I want to define is, what I want to do is to see that every state in this Boolean algebra can itself be conceived of as a Boolean valued model. And you know, for those of you who work with Boolean valued models, like Carolyn, this will be completely obvious, but nonetheless. So every state in the Boolean algebra is a Boolean valued universe in the following sense. For every set, for every Boolean valued set, U, which is a function, we can define what the set is according to that restricted Boolean algebra BA. So if you take just a drop from A, then you'll have a restricted Boolean algebra. If this is a complete Boolean algebra, the drop from A will also be a complete Boolean algebra. If this has the countable chain condition, this will have it, and so on. So if we have this function here that's defined on the Boolean algebra, then the relativization to this restricted Boolean algebra takes everything that's above A to A, right? So that's going to be our new top element. So if you had something which was sent to the top, then it will have to be sent to the top here too, but now the top is going to be A. If you have something which is sent to something which is incompatible with A, well then let it be undefined. That's what's written there. If it's sent to something which is below A, but compatible with A, well, then let it be sent to the intersection of these two things. That is this connection. For each element, the universe that is connected for each element of the Boolean algebra, the Boolean valued universe that is connected to this, that is determined by this point, will consist of all the of all these restricted sets. And then you can show, I've sort of explained already why this is, that all these restricted universes also make all the axioms of set FC true. If this is a complete algebra, then this will also be a complete algebra. You build up the sets in exactly the same way, but except that you know, have a smaller algebra to work with, it will make all of set FC true. Is that more or less clear? Because that's the only little trick that's in here. All right, now we can reverse the arrows, because if we have any Boolean valued set here, our problem was that the arrows go in the wrong direction. They go from the outcome space to the state space, but they should go from the state space to the outcome space, right? So we have to reverse these arrows. So for any U take, let u star be the function which, for any point in the state space, takes point A in the state space, takes u relativized to A as its value. So for instance, if you take the value of this point in the state space will be this u sub A that has these, that is undefined here, but it is defined here and here, and it is defined as follows. Right, then it's easy to see, and it's pretty much immediate, that there's a unique correspondence between the u's and the u stars, right? One-to-one correspondence between them. So that means that we could rewrite the whole model definition in terms of the u stars and have everything go on in the same way. We could rewrite the truth definition, for instance. I'm not going to do that here. That would take me too long. And the reason why we want to think in terms of the u stars and not in terms of the u's is that the u stars are arbitrary objects, right? The u stars, what does it do? Give me an element in your Boolean algebra, I'll give you something in the outcome space. So the arrows go in the right direction. That's the only little trick here. Okay. So we will take our VB to consist of the U stars rather than the U's, and we will assume in the background that we've rewritten everything in terms of the U stars. Well, these are arbitrary objects. What kind of arbitrary objects? Well, these states are not all maximally specific. Indeed, as if the algebra has no atoms, then there will be no maximally specific states, so no Carnapian possible worlds. By the way, those of you who stay in the of the speakers who stay in the Hotel Graf Zeppelin, there's a Zeppelin right out there in the back of you, behind you. So. Well, but people who don't live here.
Yes.
So this is how people move around in this area here. Okay. So the states are non-maximally specific situations. Fine, right? That accords with this picture that I painted in the beginning. The values are arbitrary objects and not specific objects generally, which is also fine. And well, these U stars are totally defined on the state space. All right. Okay. Now here's my view. Now I'm ready to state the view. Our set theoretic universe is VB for some complete Boolean algebra B. Now I can say this. I could have said this in the beginning, but now I can say this in the light of arbitrary object theory. This has to be taken with a grain of salt, right? Because in the same way as saying that the natural number 13 is the Zermelo number 13, the empty set with lots of brackets around it. Well, that has to be taken with a grain of salt. It isn't really, right? This is the kind of reductionism that we don't want for reasons that are familiar from the last 50 years of discussions in philosophy of mathematics. In the same sense, an arbitrary object is not a function in the sense that I've defined it, but it is a really good way of modeling it. So that's all I'm claiming, right? So metaphysically, from a metaphysical point of view, I would say, well, the set theoretic universe is an arbitrary entity. If it really is, then it doesn't consist of these kind of functions, but it can be really modeled really well as these kind of functions, which is all that we need to claim anyway. Now, this VB consists of arbitrary objects. It consists of U stars. So it consists of arbitrary objects, right? These Boolean valued sets are arbitrary objects, and that's a metaphysical thesis. And VB as a whole is itself an arbitrary object, because the VBAs are its states, right? So this is a state that VB could be in. This, if you take the drop from this and the restricted universe to that, is a state that our universe could be in, and so on and so forth. So our universe is an object that could be in many states. Give me this state, then that's the universe. Give me this state, then that's the universe, and so on and so forth. That's the picture. Now I want to try to connect this a little bit with mathematical practice, and I will get to addressing Neil's point. So Hamkins, so these days in philosophy of set theory, the multiverse picture is very much in the picture, so to speak. So, and here's a typical quote by Joel Hamkins about it. He says, the abundance of set theoretical possibilities poses a serious difficulty for the universe view. For if one holds that there is a single absolute background concept of set, then one must explain, or explain away as imaginary, all of the alternative universes that set theorists seem to have constructed. This seems a difficult task, for we have a robust experience in these worlds and they appear fully set theoretic to us. He says things like, well, we've been in these worlds, we've walked around there, we've traveled around, they seem perfectly natural places to be. Okay, well, the picture that I'm painting has a connection to the multiverse views. It is an absolutist interpretation, though. So I'm saying that our universe is VB for some B, or something like that. It can be modeled as VB. So that's an absolutist picture. There's only one set theoretic universe. Not that you have this universe, that universe, that universe is difficult, different. But there's a connection. If you take a maximal anti-chain, a partition of unity in this Boolean algebra, then the universes that are determined by these points form a Boolean valued multiverse, right? They mutually exclude each other and are jointly exhaustive. And they can be turned into classical two-valued models in standard ways. So you might be able to obtain multiverses that people like Hamkins like from a VB here, from one of these VBs. But there are some constraints, right? So if we think back to this quote, then VB must be rich enough to contain what set theoretic practice reveals as set theoretic possibilities. I take this to be the take-home message of this Hamkins quote. But that means that there are some constraints on the Boolean algebra and constraints on V. So, for instance, our Boolean algebra could be the 0-1 algebra. Well, then we would just have the old Platonistic picture back. But Hamkins would say that doesn't give us a rich enough interpretation of set theory, right? So we don't want B, we want B to be bigger than just the 0-1 algebra, that's for sure. Even though in a canonical way, V is canonically embedded in any of these universes in here, right? So somehow we want B to be so rich that for any reasonable notion of forcing, or any foundationally important notion of forcing, you can find a corresponding model somewhere in the picture here as one of these VB sub A's. That's what we want. That means that B will have to satisfy some constraints. It's not even clear that B can be taken to be a set, which is what I've assumed so far, right? So that's why I'm very interested in learning about class forcing from Kaolin. not at all clear. And I have very little that's specific to say here. Also, there are constraints on this canonically embedded two-valued universe here. So for instance, and that is because we don't just want to be taking the forcing message into account. We also want to take the large cardinal message into account. So for instance, if V would be L, then there would not be the situations with the large cardinals that we want to have in our universe. So there are really questions here about which I don't really have a lot to say, but it means that not anything goes. That's all I can say at this point. And you might even wonder whether this two-valued universe, which is canonically embedded in VB, whether that should be a possible state of VB. If it is, then VB will have to contain at least one atom, right? Things to think about, I think. The last element is about identity. So now you might say at this point, well, there's something really wrong with this, because you are assuming indeterminate identity, an indeterminate identity relation, because there will be, in this VB, there will be some xi and some eta, such that xi equals eta gets an intermediate truth value, some Boolean value which is not zero and which is not one. Right? That means indeterminate identity. But we philosophers, we metaphysicians, we figured out in the 1970s that indeterminate identity is incoherent, and that's Evans' argument. So here's Evans' argument for maybe the set theorists. Consider an X and an Y that are not determinately identical. Then X has a property, namely being identical to X, that Y doesn't have. So by Leibniz's principle of the indiscernibles of identicals, X and Y are then determinately different from each other. So if they're not determinately identical, then they're determinately different. So there seems to be no room for a xi and an eta such that the truth value of their identity is somewhere in between, some sort of Boolean value in between. And then what the philosophers like to draw as a conclusion from this is there's no vagueness in the world. Your picture seems to have worldly vagueness. That's bad. There's only semantic vagueness. And indeed, I think half unconsciously, set theorists have taken this message on board in some sense. So when you look at, for instance, the post-set approach to forcing, it's all in terms of the P names, right? So here, the counterparts of these Boolean valued sets in the post-set approach is the names. And just calling them names means that you don't take them ontologically seriously. I take them ontologically seriously. So there may be an issue here, right? Okay, so my here's an example that will illustrate. So my view is, yes, in set theory, when the identity symbol doesn't mean the real identity, the real metaphysical identity relation. It's a congruence relation, which is not the same as the metaphysical identity relation. We should be familiar with that from other areas of mathematics, where it's often said that, there's a slogan that the category theorists, especially the more philosophical ones, like to throw around, and as identity is isomorphism, right? So. So the philosophical notion, the metaphysical notion of identity is not how identity functions in many areas of mathematics. Often set theory is seen as an exception from this. And the reason is, of course, the set theory is rock bottom somehow, and you cannot go deeper in some sense. But we are going deeper, right? So the truth conditions for set theory are here given in metaphysics, in arbitrary object theory. So we are going deeper. So here's an example. So consider a little Boolean algebra. It's like this, right? I'm almost done here. 1, 0, A, B. Very simple Boolean algebra. And let xi be consist be a Boolean valued set, i.e. a function, which sends the empty set to 1 and the function from the empty set to 1 to 1. So it's, so to speak, I mean, the perfectly determinate set 0, 1. That's how mathematicians would think of this. Right, and let eta be also a Boolean valued set, which sends u to 1 and v to 1, where u and v are anti-correlated Boolean valued sets. So where u sends the empty set to A, v sends the empty set to B, and where u sends the number 1, so to speak, to B, v sends the number 1 to A. Then clearly, in the strict set theoretic sense, I would say almost in the metaphysical sense, they're different. Nonetheless, if you calculate the truth value of this statement in this model, you'll see that it's 1. So I would say the way I would paraphrase this is that in set theory, we truly say that these two things are identical to each other, but metaphysically, they're not. In metaphysics, we say they're not identical to each other. So the equality symbol in set theory does not express the real identity relation, but instead it measures coincidence in state. So in some sense, the message here is that set theory is more like other areas of mathematics than it's often taken to be. Okay, I think my time is up here, so I will leave it to this. Thank you.